Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 54 of Season 5 Move Around Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1990 Bruce Willis action flick Die Hard 2, Die Harder, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Hal Bryan of the Rocketeer Minute. Welcome back, Hal.
Well, thanks, Rob. It's great to be back. Having a lot of fun this week.
Yeah, me too. I mean, my systems only just came back online just this very second, but we're still good.
Excellent.
You didn't get that that was a line from the movie, but okay.
You took me a second because we had a minor technical issue yesterday. So I was giving you the benefit of the doubt there, but okay, you got it.
That's fine. No problem. So minute 54 begins with Thompson recalibrating and ends with John making an inquiry. So yesterday we ended things by beginning to hear a little bit of Stewart's new plan, where he gives Thompson an order to recalibrate the ILS system minus 200 feet, which thankfully Hal was able to explain to us yesterday how that is impossible. So thank you once again. Anyone who wants to hear that explanation, hopefully you've already listened to yesterday's episode, and if not, you can go back and listen to it. You know, and basically at this point we get about 10 or 12 seconds of just seeing Thompson, you know, fiddling around with the different instruments of the ILS landing system. You said you're a little familiar with the system. Does this look like the real system, Hal?
No, it doesn't. I mean, the only thing that's sort of familiar now, granted, I'm used to it from the, you know, sort of the customer side, as opposed to, you know, sort of behind the scenes like this. I mean, there's symbology, because he's got the light pen and he's drawing on the CRT there. I mean, that symbology, that sort of that arrow that shows that pathway down, and the information about the glide slope, the showing the degrees of the glide slope stuff. I mean, the stuff that we're seeing there, and then you see two different altitudes. You see that there's the middle marker. It says 476 feet, and then in parentheses, 173 feet. So those should be sea level altitudes, and then in parentheses, the altitudes above ground level. So when we're flying, big airliners have, and stop me if this gets too arcane, but the airliners and commercial aircraft have something that most that we in general aviation aircraft usually don't have, and that's a radar altimeter, which shoots does what it sounds like. It shoots radar beams at the ground and tells you how high you are off of the ground. But most airplanes, you know, private recreational airplanes, don't have that. We have an altimeter, which is basically a barometer with needles on it, and that we really only know how far we are above sea level. And then they have to be recalibrated periodically. So
that's why in movies you always see them, that's what's always spinning really fast when someone's in a dive, you know.
Right.
And it always used to drive me crazy wondering why it's spinning like that, until I realized that there's a counter below it, that the counter is actually changing. Just the fact that the arrow is going very fast doesn't mean that you're really going that fast. It's, you know, you're not going completely out of control there. You know, there's something beyond that, that it's counting down.
Right.
But I wouldn't want to be in that situation anyway.
Yeah, exactly. So I guess to answer your question, you know, what we see on the screen with the light pen, I don't think that screen exists, and it's certainly not something you could just sort of drag and change things. But they went to some effort to put, you know, in making a fake screen, they put some plausible stuff into it. I don't recall the elevation of Dulles. I could look it up real quick off the top of my head, but I would say, what they're showing here is that it would be about 300, just right about 300 feet above sea level, which sounds possible to me. 312 feet is the elevation. So they went to some trouble to dummy up this this display.
They actually say I see it says on the bottom 313. You can see that later on. There's a better shot of it.
Gotcha.
So that is pretty good. That means they really are very close. If he's just 312, 313, all right, we'll give him that. if you're off by one, that's all right.
Right. Well, and it could have changed. If at any point you want, we can talk about how they were flying onto runway 29 left, and how there is no 29 left at Dulles anymore.
Was there
30?
Was there in 1990?
There certainly would have been. So
okay, well they changed it because Windsor 114 crashed in there.
Right, exactly. That's out of respect for the victims on Windsor 114.
That's right.
So here's a trivia question for you. Do you have any guesses? So spoiler alert, that runway, and I'm making a very plausible assumption here. I'm not saying it couldn't have been torn up and repaved or rebuilt in 30 years. I don't know the history of Dulles Airport. But any guesses as to why in 1990 it was runway 29 and why today it's runway 30?
Wait, did anything leave Dulles on 9/11? No, nothing crashed there. So they get rid of, they change flight number. They don't use flight numbers that crash, but, they wouldn't change the,
right.
That it maybe because maybe has something to do with the airspace that if you're coming in on, to 29, L, you'd be going over an airspace that in 1990 was not restricted and today it is restricted. Am I close?
That's a plausible answer, but you're looking at man-made causes, and this is something that's very much not man-made. So runway numbers are two digits, and they are they refer to the compass heading of the runway.
Okay.
So in this case, runway 29 points 290 degrees.
Okay.
So west is 270. So, this is basically a runway that points to the west. And that same runway on the other end would have the number 11 because it's 180 degrees off. So going right. This direction, it's runway 29. Going the other direction, it's 11 or 110.
Okay.
It changes because, and that's all done with respect to magnetic north, and runways get repainted and renamed when... let me back up. I'll say 29. Maybe back then it was 292 degrees or 294 degrees. They round it to the nearest 10 and then drop off the zero.
Okay.
But the magnetic headings change over time as the North Pole moves around. The magnetic North Pole is constantly in motion. Sometimes it's pretty close to Canadian territory. Sometimes it's closer to Russian territory. And so at some point over the years, this airport was resurveyed, and they found out that runway 29 now points probably 297 degrees, which that's closer to 30.
Okay.
If it went from 294 to 297 as the North Pole moved. So they would have at some point when the rounding becomes in favor of the next number going up or down, they'll actually, and it's a big deal. They have to, resurface, repaint that part of the runway, republish all of the charts, all of the instrument approach procedures and everything like that. Wow. But it does have to happen periodically because the North Pole just won't hold still.
Wow. Have you ever flown into Dulles as a pilot?
As a pilot, no. Okay. No, and I think I've been into Dulles and Reagan just as a passenger, but no, never as a pilot.
Mm, okay.
It's intriguing. It's kind of a bucket list thing to think about, but the airspace is post 9/11 in particular is so ridiculously complex there. I'm not sure how hard I'll ever fight for it. The one thing that I would love to do is at Dulles, the Smithsonian Institution has the Udvar-Hazy Center, which is part of their Air and Space Museum, and they do host a small invitation only fly-in every year. And so that's kind of a rare exception that you see. I don't know if it's a dozen or so private general aviation airplanes coming in there with sort of special permissions and special procedures, and that That itself would be kind of a bucket list thing. So who knows?
Maybe one of these days. All right. Well, you just have to get yourself invited.
That's right. I know some people. We'll see.
There you go. You gotta, you know, use those connections you got.
Right.
All right. So Thompson makes this change, you know, which, you know, as we've discussed over the last few days, is completely implausible in our world, but in their world, they for some reason have a system that will allow you to do something like this. You'd think that the system would tell you that you can't do that, but okay, whatever. And then, you know, we then hear one of the, they show us then the tower, and one of the technicians, actually, I guess the guy who's in charge of this ILS system, looks out and goes, oh, Jesus, they've reset the ground level minus 200 feet. You know, so I like the fact that they actually let us see the reaction in the tower. Like, it's not as if they've cut off all communications. They've allowed the tower to see everything that's going on, but they have no control over it, which I think makes things even more frustrating for the people in the tower. You know, because here, these are guys who, this is their job, and they're looking at someone else who's messing with it. You know, that type of thing. And
yeah, it would be horrific.
Yes, correct. And then Stuart then pretends to be the tower itself, and he talks to the flight, and he goes, Windsor flight 114, this is Dulles Approach, do you copy? And then the pilot says, Dulles Approach, this is Windsor 114, where the devil have you been? Now, I'm assuming you recognize who this actor is, right?
Oh, it's Cole Meany.
That is correct. That is Cole Meany.
Chief O'Brien.
That is correct. He is, so he was born in 1953, which means that at the time of this movie, he was 37 years old. He has 138 IMDb credits. Included among them are, he had roles in Con Air, Under Siege, Come See the Paradise, Far and Away, Last of the Mohicans, Mystery Alaska, this movie, obviously. And then his largest amount of bulk of credits go for his Star Trek appearances. He was in 52 episodes of Star Trek The Next Generation playing O'Brien, and then he was in 173 episodes of Deep Space Nine. He is the only actor to appear in 14 different seasons of Star Trek shows, wow. which is pretty amazing. You know,
that's a cool bit of trivia.
Yeah. He's also like one of four people that was in more than one finale. And, you know, there's a whole bunch of other trivia things about him as, you know, and also, you know, he was in three movies in the 90s that deal with terrorism. You know, he's in this movie Under Siege and Con Air. And obviously in each one of them, he plays a different type of role. You know, he's actually one of the bad guys in Under Siege. In this movie, he's, I guess, just the pilot. No offense, Hal, by saying just the pilot.
None taken.
and in, you know, Con Air, shout out to Jay and Mark doing their Con Air minute. Or Con Air, I always say that. A shout out to Jay and Mark on the Con Air pod. You know, he either plays the CIA agent. Or some sort of government official. And so, yeah, so here he is in this movie. I remember when I saw this movie that everyone was thrilled to see him because it was just like two or three years that he had already been in Star Trek The Next Generation. So everyone recognized him. You know, and then we have Stuart responding, Windsor 114, Dulles Approach. We've been right here all along, old buddy. Our systems only came back online just this very second. And then he goes, Windsor 114, you're cleared for ILS approach, runway 29er. Contact Dulles Tower frequency at the outer marker. Okay, do you want to like quickly explain what the outer marker is? Because
sure.
I sort of understand what it is, but you know, I don't 100% know.
Right. So basically, you know, the whole instrument landing system is a series of radio transmitters that send out kind of invisible beams that are then interpreted by at this point in aviation, by gauges now, you know, certainly glass displays have taken over in the cockpit of the airplane. So you've got a few different components. You've got the localizer, which is a thing that tells you whether you're lined up left and right. The glide slope, which is the thing that they're manipulating here. It's that, you know, when you see it on the screen, it's represented by that big, long, stretched out arrow. So that's just the vertical descent path that you would take to the runway. And then the markers, you've got three. You've got the outer, the middle, and the inner. And those are, I don't know how to describe it. So very, like, narrowly focused transmitters that as you pass over them, just you have a series of lights on the instrument panel. It'll say OMI, and it'll beep and flash as you pass over it, or either flash or just sort of come to full brightness and then sort of fade out. So it's just they truly are just markers, and it's one more way of saying. You've got your localizer. Am I good left and right? Your glide slope is telling you, am I good sort of up and down, and am I coming at the right angle? And then these three marker positions are just landmarks that tell you this is where you are on this whole path from the sky down to the runway. So and it's not atypical to be told to contact the control tower when you get to the outer marker. That could be a point where approach controller would then send you to the tower. Again, sort of two very different facilities and buildings and things. But it is unusual in this case that they didn't give them the actual frequency. Most of the time, any controller, when they tell you, go talk to somebody else, they tell you what radio frequency. So they would tell you, you know, contact Dulles Tower at the outer marker on, you know, 118.5 or whatever the actual frequency was. More than you wanted to know, but that's okay.
Yeah, no, that's fine. It's great. Thank you very much. So it helps me understand a little more what's going on here. So I do appreciate that. And then we see John's listening on the cell phone once again to everything going on.
That magic cell phone.
and then he screams, "Jesus Christ! He's gonna crash the f-ing plane." So does this mean that he actually heard the controller say that that's what they're doing? You know, because again,
so,
you know, how did John know this?
You know, that's a good question. My guess was because I don't think John is in a position to have picked up on the recalibration. Does that make sense to you?
That's my point.
Right. Because
that's what I'm saying.
He's not in the same room with everybody. Sorry. I'm just thinking out loud through this.
Right.
So I think just the fact that he knows that this guy is giving them a clearance, you know, he's talking to them, pretending to be Dulles Approach, giving them a clearance. I think he's just deduced that whatever he's going to do, maybe he's going to collide two airplanes or order a descent to an, you know, impossible altitude or something. So I think he's just figured out, yeah, they're going to crash the airplane. He just probably doesn't know exactly how at this point.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, that's fair. I mean, he can hear Stuart talking to the plane. That's the thing.
Right.
He just doesn't know what he's going to do.
A bad guy is posing as a controller. And,
right.
You know, the obvious inference is, well, he's a bad guy. He's going to do something bad.
Right. Now, I've actually always wondered this. When you look at the cockpit of a plane, does it make a difference if the pilot is on the right or the left? I mean, is it like a standard thing?
Well, there is a standard that says that the command pilot or the captain sits on the left, except in most helicopters, then it's on the right. And nobody I've ever talked to can tell me why.
Okay. All right.
Generally
speaking, and it can't be because the helicopters are made in England or something.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Not right-hand drive.
Well, that's what I was wondering here when I first saw Colmini. I was like, okay, maybe he's supposed to be, maybe he's driving on the wrong side. You know, he's flying on the wrong side.
Right, because it's Windsor Air. Yeah, exactly. That's right. For the most part, their controls are the same. And in a modern airliner in particular, Everything is pretty well duplicated on both sides. Certainly, you know, most airplanes that are side by side like that, in particular, you're going to have both pilots are going to have a control yoke and rudder pedals. They likely share a throttle quadrant in the middle, and then would have, you know, would have displays that that match things. In some airplanes, when you get into smaller airplanes, you'll still find two sets of controls, but the gauges and things, they are, the emphasis is on putting them on the left so that the pilot in command has full view. And so somebody on the right doesn't have a full sort of duplicate complement of all the gauges and things.
Okay. All right. That's great. And then, so the pilot of Windsor 114 says, "Roger, approach, and about time. I've got 230 people up here flying on petrol fumes." And then the response he gets is, "Roger, 114, understand, calibrate Dulles altimeter." And then, you know, the technician that we had earlier is still looking and he goes, "Oh, Jesus, they'll fly right into the concrete." Exactly. And then Trudeau starts to get angry and goes, "Son of a bitch."
I love him.
And then we see John still listening on the cell phone, and then John starts asking Barnes a question. He goes, "Why are they listening?" And then he gets cut off. So what he says here about calibrate Dulles altimeter, that also is something that you would normally say?
Not in those terms. You wouldn't say the word calibrate, but that is what you're doing. Is you will just hear on the radio, if you ever listen to any aircraft radio for any period of time, they would tell you Dulles altimeter, you know, 29 or 81, or you know, so and so, such and such altimeter setting, and then they give you a 4-digit number, which is the current in the U.S. here in the U.S. it's barometric pressure in inches of mercury, and elsewhere in the world they work on a standard of millibars. But it had come up a little bit earlier. We talked about that an altimeter is really a barometer, you know, with, in this case, needles on it in a physical gauge. And so you need to know, wherever you're flying, you need to periodically find out the barometric pressure at the nearest weather station. So in this case, it's not a courtesy per se, but it's an extra bit of information that, you know, they probably already know the latest altimeter setting, but the controller would tell you in that transmission, you know, Dulles altimeter 29 or 86, and so then the pilot or in many cases both pilots would then dial that number into the altimeter so that their altimeter properly reflects their altitude above sea level, which is, it was interesting in this case because the terrorists could have given, and in fact should have given, a bogus altimeter setting to make them less likely to catch on to this whole 200-foot discrepancy. And we don't really see that, because that an airliner is still just not going to fly blindly into the ground because an altimeter was set incorrectly, but there have been,
maybe Chief O'Brien just isn't a really good pilot.
That could be too. Maybe he's just a terrible pilot. There was
he's used to flying in space.
Not on Earth. You know, we talked yesterday about a couple of T-38 crashes, and there was a very famous, maybe late 70s crash involving the four T-38s of the Thunderbirds demonstration squadron. And some accounts say that one was attributed to an incorrect altimeter setting. So you have that wrong number dialed in there, and you think you're, you know, if you've got four airplanes and you're in tight formation doing aerobatics low to the ground and you're coming out of the bottom of the loop and, you know, just, I'm making up some numbers here, but if you think you're 100 feet off the ground and you're really not, or you think you're 200 feet off the ground and you're really only 50 feet off the ground, but it was a terrible crash in which the lead pilot flew straight into the ground and the formation pilots just followed him right in perfect formation because they don't take their eyes off the boss. Well, and as I said, some accounts at least attribute that in part to not having the correct altimeter setting, which means not having the current barometric pressure so that your gauges are calibrated correctly.
Well, if what you were saying is correct about the Thunderbird, so if it was miscalibrated just on the lead plane, wouldn't the others have like some sort of warning sign or something like that? That even if they're just looking at the lead, if they get like a a warning beep or something like that, wouldn't they? I don't know how that works.
So this is outside of typical area of expertise, but I think there's a couple of things that could have happened. Number one is the fact that they truly, when they're in tight formation like that, you've got an airplane, four airplanes. I know the Blue Angels, when they fly, the Thunderbirds don't fly as tight as the Blue Angels, but the Blue Angels fly with 18 inches of separation between wingtips and the diamond formation. It's unbelievable. And you think how close that is. So pilots are truly, there's absolute trust in who's leading that formation. And when they're in their diamond, they are not looking anywhere. The only person who has the luxury of stealing a glance at the gauges would be the person in the number one position.
Okay.
Now there's a good possibility that the idea of the altimeter setting being wrong there being, could be apocryphal, but it's certainly plausible, and it would have, it would have reinforced the ruse in the movie. Had they done it. So the fact that they didn't give a number or say anything, but at least they acknowledged, hey, calibrate your altimeter. That was a smart move on behalf of the writers to put that in there so that we're at least acknowledging that, yes, that was probably part of the ruse.
Right. Okay. That's fair. So you have anything else you want to say about this minute before we get into the script?
Yeah, I think we're good.
All right. So the script has some changes here. So it starts off with Stuart, talking to Windsor 114, and then it says everyone in the tower reacts to Stuart's voice and the chilling lie he's just told in an affable good old boy tone that's totally different from anything they've heard up until then. And then the British pilot responds, saying, where have you been? And then Stuart says, we've been right here, old man. And in the movie he says old buddy. I think old buddy sounds a little better anyway. And then it continues through the conversation. You have approach on runway 29, report to the tower at the outer marker, and then McLean goes, Christ, he's bringing them down. I do like Bruce Willis's reaction about he's going to crash the plane a little better than he's going to bring them down.
Right.
It gives more urgency to what's going on.
It does.
The way that he delivers it.
Bringing them down is what, you're missing the word safely, but bringing them down is what the job of these controllers would be to do. And so that doesn't have that, as you said, that same urgency as crashing the airplane,
Yeah, that's right.
Bringing them down can mean crashing, or it can just mean bringing them in for a nice safe landing. The line is much, much more powerful as delivered.
Yeah. And then, the pilot says, Roger, approach in about time. I've got 230 people up here flying on petrol fumes. And then Trudeau goes, the son of a bitch, the goddamn son of a bitch. And then Stuart continues replying to the pilot and says, I'll bet. Okay, calibrate your altimeter at setting 2992. Oh. Turning you over to tower now.
So there's that four-digit number I promised you.
There you go. That's right. And then McLean goes, what? And then Trudeau goes, that's the runway between here and the new terminal. He wants to make all of us watch it. And then it says, pushes in on McLean as he looks out the window. Barnes screams, don't do it, you bastards. Don't do it. And that's what we got here. So every Thursday, we have a segment called Aviation Thursday, where my guests will give their top five movies somehow related to airplanes or airports or aircrafts or something of that sort. So Hal, I'm sure this was even harder for you to put together to choose top five, but if you can, give us your top five, start with number five and work your way up.
All right, here's my top 500 as requested. So sit back. It was tough. Aviation.
We have 3 hours. Go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. We got plenty of time. I looked in my personal movie collection. I think there are more than 400 movies that specifically tie to aviation and have that tag in my database. So yeah,
I wonder why.
Yeah, I wonder why. Not easy. So lots of honorable mentions. I'll spare you those. And again, I'm not necessarily wedded to the order of 3, 4, and 5 here. It's pretty good ties. But number 5, I have Iron Eagle. A wonderful guilty Ooh. Pleasure of a movie that came out about 6 months before Top Gun. And yes. I joke with people that it has aged better than Top Gun because Iron Eagle was ridiculous when it came out, and it's exactly as ridiculous now, whereas Top Gun was incredible, and I dearly love it when it came out, but it hasn't aged all that well. It looks a lot sillier now. So Iron Eagle, Doug Masters flying the F-16, just guilty pleasure, but I own it.
Okay.
Number 4, Tora, 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 recreating the attack on Pearl Harbor, massive undertaking in building airplanes, replicas of Japanese airplanes to fly for that movie, and some incredible flying scenes, a lot of great warbirds. The Great Waldo Pepper, mentioned that a bit yesterday with my flying story. Robert Redford as a ex-World War I pilot turned barnstormer, turned movie pilot. So a movie that's a great look at the world of barnstorming and early 20th century aviation, and a great look at filmmaking of that time as well. Number 2 for me, The Battle of Britain. And it honestly fights hard for number 1, but you can probably guess because of my other podcast that The Rocketeer has to have that number 1 spot. An absolute love letter to the golden age of aviation.
And one of the things I wanted to say about today, you know, it's Thursday, the 27th of July, and this is actually my wedding anniversary. So I wanted to give a shout out to my wife, who doesn't listen to the show, and thank her for so far 13 wonderful years. Like I said, she doesn't listen to the show, so it doesn't really matter. You all now know it's my anniversary, but, you know, she knows it's my anniversary too, but not via the podcast.
So. Oh, well, happy anniversary to you both. My wife and I were also married in July. So when this airs, it'll be about 2 weeks after.
All right. Very cool. All right. So you want to once again tell people how they can get in touch with you?
Absolutely. You can find me via the Green Dot podcast, which I do as one of the hosts as part of the Experimental Aircraft Association's podcast, at inspire.eaa.org. The Rocketeer Minute is easy enough at rocketeerminute.com. Both the Rocketeer Minute and the Green Dot can be found just about anywhere you get your podcasts, and that's even on YouTube now, or at least the Rocketeer Minute is on YouTube. Of course, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Audible.com carries both, which has been a nice way to get some new listeners. So you can find me all over those places.
All right. Very cool. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Move Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. And you can find me on my website, MoveAroundMinute.com. So Hal, you feel like coming back in tomorrow to actually look at the inside of a plane in the cabin?
Let's do that, and let's finish out the week. That'll be fun.
All right, great. So until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay.
If you're fond of sand dunes and salty air, quaint little village.